Hi, I'm Jay Farner, CEO of Quicken Loans. 30% of Americans who are planning home improvements of $5,000 or more will pay for those renovations with a high-interest credit card. That may not be a great idea. A better idea may be to take cash out of your home with a Quicken Loans 30-year fixed-rate mortgage. The rate today on our 30-year fixed-rate mortgage is 4.375%. APR, 4.65%. Call us today at 800-QUICKEN or go to rocketmortgage.com.
Rate subject to change. Pay 2.13% fee to receive this discounted rate. Call for cost information and conditions. Equal housing lender. License in all 50 states. NMLS number 3030.
This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
There are hundreds, if not thousands, of fairy tales that have been collected over the centuries. But if you think back to your childhood, there are probably only a handful that you would go back to again and again and again. Why is that? What makes a particular fairy tale more meaningful to you? It's the evening edition. I'm Tasha Fusil, and this is Happily Ever After, a series that's all about the fairy tales that we fell in love with once upon a time. Tonight, we're going to try and figure out what it is about some fairy tales that children just can't seem to get enough of. And I'll be doing that with Shelton Cashton.
Well, I'm a retired college professor at the University of Massachusetts. My specialty is psychology, specifically clinical psychology. And I spent just a number of years teaching undergraduates and graduates psychotherapy and clinical psychology in general.
Sheldon's also a child psychologist, and he wrote a book called The Witch Must Die, which explores the kinds of connections that we make with fairy tales when we read them as kids.
The thing that kind of drove me to investigate it was the fact that fairy tales were more than just entertainment. And I started looking at what might be a deeper meaning or a deeper draw for fairy tales. And that in turn led me to the idea that fairy tales perform some kind of psychological function.
Okay, so at this point, I had no idea what psychological function Sheldon was referring to. Because as a kid, I never saw any deeper meaning to Sleeping Beauty or Snow White. I probably had the same thoughts that you did. Thoughts like, how cool would it be to have a fairy godmother? Or, I wish I too could speak to birds.
When a child reads these stories or sees the movie version of it, they don't sit and say, gee, I wonder what meaning this has. They either enjoy it or don't enjoy it.
But according to Sheldon, these psychological functions are happening on a much more subconscious or subliminal level.
Because usually when adults read books or see movies, they're attracted to it and they enjoy it and they go on to the next one. But there's this phenomenon in children that they keep going back to the stories over and over and over again, which led me to believe that the stories had a deeper meaning, even though at the time the child is reading them, they don't recognize that.
And when kids do keep coming back to the same cartoons, what are they going back to? What is it that they're enjoying when they watch this?
Well, children are always exposed to different conflicts in their lives, well, as do adults. But if you look at a child's existence, they face conflicts having to do with greed, with having to tell lies or not to tell lies. They break something, a vase, for example, in the house, and when a mother comes in and says, who broke them, the child will make up a story, the dog knocked it over, or something of that sort. Or when children play with other children, they tend to be greedy. They want a little more than they might deserve. So what I kind of reasoned was that what fairy tales do is allow children to kind of face these conflicts and to some extent resolve them.
A good example to look at could be perhaps one of the most famous fairy tales that we know of, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs.
That story basically has to do with vanity and looks and how sometimes as children and as adults we prize that more than other kinds of qualities in a person, like kindness, thoughtfulness, intelligence, and so on, will try to give too much weight to looks. So you have the evil queen in the story constantly looking in the mirror and saying, mirror, mirror, on the wall.
Who is the fairest one of all?
Famed is thy beauty, Majesty. But hold, a lovely maid I see. Alas, she is more fair than thee.
Alas for her.
She is so consumed with her looks and being the fairest of them all, she even goes to the extent of trying trying to murder her stepdaughter, who's Snow White, because she feels Snow White is prettier than her.
And I guess emphasis on beauty is definitely a very strong sort of recurring theme in a lot of the stories and in a lot of the fairy tales that we see, like with Sleeping Beauty, with Beauty and the Beast. I mean, the word beauty is in there. Like, so as a child, if I were to read these stories, I would think that, oh, society really prizes beauty. The prince falls in love with the princess, not because of her personality, because of who she is, but because she's a pretty girl.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with you. But the whole gist of the story in the end is that the emphasis on looks is overemphasized, and that in the end it tends to be negative, because in the story, and this applies to fairy tales that have to do with different kinds of issues like greed and lying and so on, in the fairy tale, the negative trait, the negative inclination tends to be lodged in an evil character, and in the end, the evil character has to be destroyed. In fact, that's why I named my book The Witch Must Die. So even though there are elements where this trait, like in this case vanity, tends to be prized, in the end, the message is that too much emphasis on this is going to lead to a negative end or some kind of retribution or punishment for overemphasizing that trait.
So I still think that the emphasis on princesses being loved and adored purely based on how they look is problematic. But I'm going to save that for another episode. Sheldon's main point is that fairy tales can help introduce kids to some of the more human impulses that we all have within us. It's, of course, happening subconsciously. Most kids probably wouldn't notice that the evil queen represents vanity.
Ultimately, the ability to deal with conflicts having to do with greed or lying or vanity or whatever is worked out in one's personal relationship. Your interaction with other children, with adults, and so on, leads children to learn that being greedy is going to wind up leading to rejection, for example, or lying will lead to other kinds of trouble. So they learn this in their interactions with people. The fairy tale is almost like play acting, so to speak, play acting in the mind, revolving around these issues. So the child doesn't solve the problem. It's almost like the fairy tales act as a introduction and a temporizing way of dealing with troublesome impulses.
Right, yeah, because as a kid, you see a batch of brownies on the table. You don't see it, your impulse as greed, but that's what it is. You're feeling it for the first time. You're feeling these...
Right. Yeah, I mean, the reaction to it isn't intellectual. Should I or should I not grab more than I deserve? It's just that you just have this impulse, but at some level, you realize that it's really a negative kind of reaction, and that after you take too much of whatever it is, you're not going to feel as good as you thought you would feel. So the issue, say, for example, around greed, is not resolved by reading the story, but at least it's an introduction and it's a way of symbolically dealing with that particular impulse.
I think I understand what you're saying in that, you know, when kids read fairy tales, it's not necessarily to learn clear and cut black and white sort of, you know, lessons. It's not as simple as that. It's about understanding mm-hmm. that you have these innate human impulses and it's not bad or good. It's just how you deal with it. Is that what it is?
Right, exactly. And what you just said is very important because, well, there's always a projection in the fairy tale. And what I propose in The Witch Must Die is that the child projects the bad part of the self onto the witch and the good part into the protagonist, the young child. But in lieu of what you just said, the fairy tale is not a purely good versus evil thing where you see just the witch or the ogre or the sorcerer or whatever being black and white, bad figure, and the child being this wonderful, innocent character. Because if you look at the story, you see some of these bad qualities in the child's themselves.
So if we go back to Snow White, when she was living with the dwarves, they warned her not to allow strangers to come into the house. But as we know, the evil stepmother or the witch disguised herself on a few occasions to come and tempt Snow White.
And the first time she comes to the cabin, she tempts her with a comb.
If you have lovely hair, you may want a comb in there.
So this scene might sound like it doesn't belong in any Snow White film, but it is in fact from a 1987 adaptation of Snow White. And I'm not sure why, but in this version, the Evil Queen has chosen to disguise herself as this geisha of sorts who goes around from door to door selling combs. It's a bit trippy and kind of odd, but you know, it's the 80s, so...
Painted bright, mother of pearl, just the thing for lovely girl.
She offers her this device that will make Snow White prettier, that she could comb her hair. And on a second occasion, the witch, a.k.a. the stepmother, comes back with these fancy ribbons to make Snow White look, again, pretty, and Snow White succumbs to that temptation. Even though the child represents goodness and innocence, and the witch has this quality of being consumed with looks and vanity, you still see that element in Snow White, in wanting the comb and wanting these laces. So what the story is reminding the reader is that badness isn't a strict dichotomy, that's all good or all bad, but that the child has some of the same impulses that's seen in the witch figure.
When we come back, we'll look at what other messages could be hiding behind some of our other favorite fairy tales. It's the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Hi, I'm Jay Farner, CEO of Quicken Loans. 30% of Americans who are planning home improvements of $5,000 or more will pay for those renovations with a high-interest credit card. That may not be a great idea. A better idea may be to take cash out of your home with a Quicken Loans 30-year fixed-rate mortgage. The rate today on our 30-year fixed-rate mortgage is 4.375%. APR, 4.65%. Call us today at 800-QUICKEN or go to rocketmortgage.com.
Rate subject to change. Pay 2.13% fee to receive this discounted rate. Call for cost information and conditions. Equal housing lender. License in all 50 states. NMLS number 3030.
Beyond Frivolous Matters. BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Welcome back to the Evening Edition. I'm Tasha Fusil, and this is Happily Ever After, a show that takes a closer look at some of the fairy tales that we grew up with. Now, there's a lot that we can learn from fairy tales, and tonight I'm going to take a look at a couple of stories to see what deeper meaning they might have. Now, we've all heard the story of Jack and the Beanstalk. It's about a boy who comes across these magical beans. He plants them and they grow into this massive beanstalk, which extends all the way up into the sky. Jack climbs the beanstalk and finds himself in this whole other magical dimension where there are giants who own really nice things. Now, according to Sheldon Cashton, our guest on the show this evening, Jack and the Beanstalk is the perfect story to introduce children to the concept of greed.
Just read the story on a surface level, you can see that it has to do with wealth and having too much and whether that's a negative kind of quality. So that the ogre, for example, is consumed with collecting gold. For him, gold is the sine qua non of life. And in the beginning of the story, we see that his house is filled with bags of gold.
In addition to all his bags of gold, this ogre also has a hen that lays golden eggs and a golden harp.
So his whole life revolves around gold and the accumulation of wealth.
Kind of reminds me of another guy who loves his gold.
I love gold!
Anyway, back to Jack and the Beanstalk.
Everyone knows the story involves Jack climbing the beanstalk and confronting the ogre. Now, the first time he goes up there, he steals some bags of gold and takes it down, and he and his mother are able to buy food and other kinds of amenities and live for a while in splendor.
But the gold runs out, so he goes up a second time to steal the hen that lays the valuable eggs.
And again, he and his mother are able to buy all they need, food and so on. But then he goes up a third time to steal the golden harp. Now, the thing is that once he has the golden eggs, he doesn't need any more. This hen lays these eggs constantly, so he has an unending source of wealth. So why does Jack climb the beanstalk the third time? And the answer is that only because he's greedy. So what you have is a story that shows the evil character being greedy, but that quality being in the child as well. And in the end, the trait of greediness is lodged mainly in the ogre, and that's why the ogre, which is the witch figure, has to die. And so he does as he climbs down the beanstalk. Jack chops it down, and the ogre falls to his death.
So we've come to the end of the story, but Sheldon, you know, I was wondering, with a story like this, which is said to be thousands of years old, would this have been why the story was written in the first place? You know, were these characters created specifically to tell us that greed is, in fact, a bad thing?
You know, it's hard to tell, of course, but my sense is that they weren't. The people who wrote these stories, or they didn't even write them, they evolved out of an oral tradition. But the beginnings of these stories, I think, just started as fanciful tales, stories of little children having to face giants. It's sort of like a David and Goliath kind of scenario that people tend to be attracted to. The people who read them, and eventually the main audience turned out to be children, gravitated towards them because somehow it tapped into some psychological dynamic in the reader. So I think it evolved out of a need of children to find stories that had a deeper meaning for them rather than originating in the minds of storytellers.
So let's do a quick recap. We've talked about Snow White and we've talked about Jack and the Beanstalk. In both these stories, Sheldon's focused on the evil characters and their negative traits. The evil stepmother in Snow White was vain, and the ogre in Jack and the Beanstalk was greedy. So you may notice that there's a theme here. Vanity and greed are two of the seven deadly sins, sins which religion and philosophy have been warning us about for a pretty long time now. So with that in mind, let's look at another fairy tale, Hansel and Gretel. It's one of my favorites, and it's a story that has fascinated me since I was a kid for reasons that have been completely unknown to me until maybe today.
Once again, if you put the story itself to the side and say, what is the major element, or what is the story really about? And you find that essentially it has to do with food. Eating of food, not having enough food, or what have you. And Hansel and Gretel are, in the beginning of the story, expelled from their home because there's not enough food to feed the entire family. So they send the children out into the woods. And the next place where food figures into the story has to do with the crumbs Hansel leaves along the path from their home so they can get back. And the birds eating these little morsels of food, that leads to them going further and further into the forest. Finally, when they come across the witch's cottage, what do? They eat it. So the issue of food and eating becomes another part of the story. And finally, at the end, the witch, when she captures the children, decides that she's going to eat Hansel. So I found it was almost impossible to ignore the fact that this fairy tale has to do with food and eating, or lack of food, and maybe it's touching into the issue of when to eat, when not to eat, what to eat, and how eating figures into people's lives, and how overeating, indulgence, when it comes to food or gluttony, can be a negative kind of thing. If you look into the lives of children, you find there are many episodes involving food. In a way, they get consumed by all the food. Or when a child is with a mother in a supermarket, and the mother picks up a box of cookies, and the child says, oh, get another box. I want more of that.
Over the past decade, childhood cases of type 2 diabetes have increased tenfold.
Sweet, salty, and addictive. It's a controversial theory, but some doctors claim you can actually get hooked on food.
Our children are literally eating themselves to death.
The issue of food and eating is not just an abstraction, but it's something that is a part of every child's life. So that led me into the issue of whether the child is in a way unconsciously using the story to deal with that impulse of overeating, of gluttony. The interesting thing about that story, again, as you read it again and again, and you pick up on different aspects of the eating. Now, the witch's reputation is that she is a devourer of little children. She eats little children. But if you follow the story a little deeper, you find that after she captures the children, who are gluttonous, who keep eating, the only reason they're caught is that they stay and they keep eating and eating and eating. If they would have taken a chunk of the house and left, they wouldn't have wound up in such trouble. But getting back to the witch, she's not satisfied with just eating Hansel. I mean, she's captured them, and she could just kill him and eat him, but she decides to fatten him up. So it's like she's not satisfied with just a little bit. She has to have more and more. So that's the essence of gluttony, and this is what children have to deal with. Incidentally, on a personal level, I remember that element of gluttony, if you will, was part of my experience as a child. Because I remember once at the table, after having eaten, I wanted more of whatever it was. Maybe it was a birthday party and there was cake or so on. And I remember my mother saying to me, "Your eyes are bigger than your stomach." And that sentence always has stuck with me over the years. You're kind of over-influenced by what you see rather than what you need.
And it's scary to almost be able to identify with the scary witch. I mean, even though she's essentially a cannibal, you would think that you're 1,000 steps away from being this cannibal, but really you're not.
Right, exactly. I mean, this is why it all is happening on a subliminal or unconscious level. I mean, if you read the story and looked at the witch and said consciously, "Oh, that's me. I see myself as that ugly, terrible figure," the story, I think, would be too much of a turnoff and children wouldn't be coming back to it. But at an unconscious level, I wouldn't call it acceptable, but at least an unconscious level, it's understandable. You can touch into that negative feeling, but not fully see yourself as an evil character.
So would it be helpful for kids to consciously pick up on these messages, or would that take away too much of the magic and wonder that makes these fairy tales so interesting in the first place? We'll find out with Sheldon Cashton in just a bit. It's the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Bodacious, fabulous minds. BFM 89.9, the business station.
You're still tuned into the Evening Edition. I'm Tasha Fusil, and this is Happily Ever After, a show that takes a deeper look at the fairy tales that we grew up with. There are probably hundreds of different ways that you could interpret a fairy tale. But for tonight, we've been focusing on what fairy tales reveal about the basic human impulses that we all have. Desire for wealth or power or good looks, they're the bedrock of some of the most popular fairy tales that we know today. And my guest this evening, Sheldon Cashton, believes that it's this emphasis on these deeply ingrained impulses that keep drawing us back in to these stories again and again. In fact, there's one particular story that resonates with Sheldon the most.
You know, as I did the research and reread them, I think I tapped more into Pinocchio, in part because it's a very complex story.
I see tonight. I wish I might have the wish I make tonight. I wish that my little Pinocchio might be a real boy.
And the other is that if you read the story in the original, it really has to do with education and going to school.
Here's your book.
I'm going to school.
School. Ah, yes. Then you haven't heard of the easy road to success. No.
And the value of school. And what happens if you aren't serious enough about it?
I'm speaking, my boy, of the theater. Bright lights, music, applause, fame.
Fame?
Yes. And with
so
that personality,
the entire story has to do with Pinocchio perhaps being lazy and not wanting to go to school and being influenced by negative figures who tell him, you have more fun having fun. And I think, you know, maybe that tapped into my own, you know, early experience of saying, gee, I'd like to be outside playing rather than applying myself and sitting in a classroom all day. I'm tapping into my own unconscious.
And you reacted and then you became a professor. So there's...
Right. That's even more paradoxical, you know, after all that. And I wound up teaching people.
Well, you know, for parents, what would you say is the way to go about introducing fairy tales to their children? is it terribly important that they understand sort of the deeper meaning that there is to these fairy tales? Or is it okay for kids to, you know, take them in the way they would had they not known what the stories could be, what the moral could be?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's like the more you explain something and get too intellectual about it, the more you leave the richness of the story. So I wouldn't have a parent, you know, go to a story reading to a child and say, oh, this story has to do with greediness, or this story has to do with vanity. I think you have to leave that to the reader, to the child themselves. If there's anything that I would recommend, it's really that the parents read the original to the children or expose them in some way to it, because the children often get a kind of sugary, watered-down version of these stories by seeing the Disney movie or reading, you know, some kind of modern version of it that kind of takes the meat out of the story. The psychological job that the child does with the fairy tale is the job of the child. And to explain it takes away the richness of the story. And you would say the same thing for adults. If someone would recommend a novel to you and say to you, oh, this novel has to do with X, Y, or Z,
yeah,
it would take something away from it. You have to read it yourself. Then if the story has some resonance, some impact, you'll pick it up.
I don't know. I find there's something tricky about fairy tales. There is almost, I want to say, a slyness to them. I think because of its origins, right? Because there is a darkness to it. The way you read it could just go into many different ways. You know, it's not as innocent as you would think a story is.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But the reason you're drawn to it, it does tap into some concern you have. Like, for example, I don't know how many times I've seen, and other people have seen, The Wizard of Oz. I read The Wizard of Oz. It was my daughter's favorite story.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
And you could say to yourself, well, you know, people have seen that movie so many times. They've heard Judy Garland sing this song so many times.
Somewhere over the rainbow.
They know all about the Wicked Witch of the West and the wizard, and so why do they keep coming back and back over and over again to these stories? And again, I think the stories themselves and the characters in that story lead themselves to issues that are important for children.
So if you look at the three characters that Dorothy meets, the Scarecrow, the Tin Man, and the Cowardly Lion, they're each sort of hung up on a concern that kids may be probably experiencing for themselves.
The Scarecrow's upset because he doesn't have a brain. He's not very intelligent.
Why, if I had a brain, I could while away the hours, conferring with the flowers, consulting with the rain. And my head, I'd be scratching while my thoughts were busy hatching if I only had a brain.
Then we've got the Tin Man, who's lost his heart and doesn't feel as deeply as he'd like to.
As for you, my galvanized friend, you want a heart. You don't know how lucky you are not to have one. Hearts will never be practical until they can be made unbreakable.
But I still want one.
And the Cowardly Lion is cowardly. He's not as brave as he wish he would be.
Why, you're nothing but a great big coward.
You're right. I am a coward. I haven't any courage at all.
Now, those are concerns that children have, and maybe adults too, but that they're not as smart as they should be as the next kid, that they don't have enough feelings, compassion for other kids who are in trouble, or they're not brave enough. They don't stick up for a friend who's being bullied. So the concern having to do with intelligence, with feelings, with bravery are very common or very pressing for children. And I think it's that draws children to these stories again and again and again. So I guess the point that I'm trying to make is that if you sat down with a child and said, look, I'm going to show you a very colorful, fanciful story or read you a story that has to do with bravery, that has to do with intelligence and so on, it would take away from the flow of the tale for allowing the child to come to their own realization of what the story's about. And I think that's the important thing. If you tell people what they're supposed to feel or what they're supposed to experience, they wind up not experiencing in a personal way. So you have to trust the story. And if you read these stories to children, and let them on their own kind of extract the deeper meaning, then the stories will have a lasting psychological effect.
My thanks to Sheldon Cashton, my guest this evening and author of the book called Witch Must Die, The Hidden Meaning Behind Fairy Tales. And as usual, if you've missed any part of this interview, you can look up the podcast on our website or our app, which is available both on iPhone and Android. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tasha Fasil, and this has been Happily Ever After on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.
The Starlight Lounge presents An Evening with the Progressive Box.
Old moon, yeah. That's Hugo, tickling the ivories. He just saved by bundling home and auto with Progressive. Gonna finally buy a ring for that gal of yours, Hugo? Send her my condolences. Hi-oh! This next one's for you, too. There's a burglar in my heart. Thank you.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Discounts not available in all states or situations.